Yoga Pashupati Matang Vaishnavamiti Prabhinne Prastane Paramidamara Patyamiti Cha Ruchinam Vaichitriyad Rijukukilanana Patajusham Drinameko Gamyas Tvamasi Payasam Arnava Eva. O Lord, as the different streams rising from different sources, traveling by different means, arrive all at last and mingle their waters in the same sea, so, O Lord, do the paths men take, derived from different scriptures and according to their different tendencies, various though they may appear, crooked or straight, all at last come to Thee, O God. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu, Ma Vindushavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as Mother and Father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a Mother and Father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. I want to talk to you this morning about one of the greatest saints the world has known. And it's a celebration of his birthday, more or less, because it was a few days ago that Guru Nanak's birthday was celebrated, was known to be, in 1469. Nanak, who became later known as Guru Nanak, was born in 1469, and he was born in a very poor family, farmers in poor circumstances, very little education. Among the influences which affected him most as a child were the poet Kabir, who was almost a contemporary. And among the Sufis, the Chishti Sufis and the Suhrawardi Sufis, all had a prominent part in his early listening, I should say, not his education, because it wasn't formal education. He would go out and mingle with the passing pilgrims and the people who were devotees of this particular kind, and he would hobnobbing with them. He would pick up their songs and their doctrines and their attitudes. He showed very little interest in school. He was also a contemporary of Ramananda, if you know who Ramananda was, who died actually the year after Guru Nanak was born, died the year after Nanak was born, so he didn't have a chance to meet him, but he was influenced by his teachings and his disciples. The people whom he met and with whom he worked and with whom he associated were all very poor and lowly people. They had not very much education, but he was very concerned about them in his heart. He always felt that he should have some kind of duty in life with respect to the poor and the lowly. And as we see, he made it his appointed obligation to associate with them, try to see how he could help them, and give himself, give all of his substance and his energies to them, the poor. Well, when he was a very little boy, and then they tried to educate him, he ran off to the forest. I think you'll see as we go along with this story some similarities to the life of Sri Ramakrishna. And it's not surprising. And the people of that kind have that sort of tendency. They don't live very ordinary lives. So he would run off to the forest and meet these groups of traveling pilgrims, among them mainly the Sufis. And what he taught later and what he studied with them were the higher forms of bhakti. Instead of the bhakti which is constantly pleading for heaven and for various worldly appurtenances and comforts and improvements, he was taught by the Sufis to aspire for that love which seeks God only. And that was the love that he really had. They tried to make him a farmer. His parents tried to make him a farmer. They put him on the farm and asked him to take care of the cattle. And he strayed, and the cattle strayed. And they gave up on making him a farmer after a lot of struggle. His father despaired. He never would make any good of himself at all. Somehow, some schooling was stuffed into him. We don't know how, but he had enough language to be able to write poetry. And his poems are very simple, very beautiful. I'm going to read one or two of those verses that he composed. Anyway, with whatever little schooling he had, he managed to get along in the world. One story is told about how in school, in the class, whatever class he was in, the teacher was explaining the word Om. The teacher was talking about the word Om, rather. And Nanak asked him, can you explain the word Om to me? What does it mean? And the teacher was just using the word Om, and Nanak wanted to know what it meant. And the teacher couldn't explain it, unfortunately. So Nanak began a disquisition on the word Om and explained it all highly, to the high satisfaction of the teacher and the class. So that shows you what kind of superiority he had in his understanding. It's a deep understanding, a spiritual understanding, not a scholastic, academic understanding at all. They wanted to invest him with the sacred thread. You know, this is the ceremony which Hindus are expected to, Hindu boys are expected to adopt at the age of 8 or 9 or 10. I think he was 10 years old when they tried to give him the sacred thread ceremony. His parents were very earnest and sincere about wanting to do that because they were good Hindus, you see. And they wanted him to be a Hindu. And he didn't quite turn out that way. So what he did was, as the thread was being put on around his neck, he caught hold of it and pulled it off. And this is what he said to the priest. Out of the cotton of compassion, spin the thread of contentment. Tie the knot of continence. Give it the twist of virtue. Make such a thread, O Pandit, for your inner self. Such a thread will not break, nor get soiled, or be burnt, or lost. Yeah, saucy, wasn't he? Pretty saucy to do that. And he was just about 10 when he said that. He had no interest in food. And I wonder whether he really ate very much at all. One of those saints who doesn't seem to have had to eat. Saint Catherine of Siena was like that. She didn't eat most of her life. She died early, of course, but still, she just had no interest in food. And he seems to have been like this. He would hide in the forest when it came time to have family feasts, meals, and things like that. And there he would get engaged in conversation with the sadhus. And his learning, his poetry and his learning, and all of the mystique which he showed in later life, was the product of, as in the case of Sri Ramakrishna, was the product of the passing sadhus, the pilgrims and sadhus who passed through the area. And he was in North India, and who in Punjab, and they educated him. He got what he got. He got from them, educated in education. They called in desperation. They called for an exorcist. You know what an exorcist is? Somebody who they thought he was enchanted. He thought he was under a spell. Somebody had, you know, the village people resort to things like that. And they thought that that was what was wrong with him, and he would have to be exorcised. So they got hold of somebody who would give him those proper tortures. And the doctor, he was called a doctor. And he came, and what he said was, "You're giving me a word, a charm. You think you're giving me a charm to make me well. Our transient life, dear doctor, is a shop." Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's not the one. That comes later. I read the wrong one. No, he said, the name you're giving me, the word you're giving me, is really only another name of God. God has all the names in the world. So you are bringing me my Lord in another form. And he said, "If you think I have gone mad, I've gone mad for God." Just like Sri Ramakrishna. Just the same as him. Gone mad, I've gone mad for God. That's my way. And when the doctor, when he was ill, and they called a doctor to come and see him, the doctor was treating him, and he said, "No, I won't take any medicine. My pain is of the heart. I am in love with my Lord. What can you do?" The doctor went away. His father, in desperation, shelled out the money to buy him a shop, to make him a shopkeeper. As far as I can gather, it was one of those little store. We'd call it today a convenience store. Yeah. It was a convenience store. It was the village sell-all. Yes, we sell everything at the village. And so he thought, well, he can at least keep the accounts and run this, work on this shop. And this is what he said. He worked in the shop for a while. This is what he said. "Our transient life is a shop. The holy name is our merchandise. Alertness of mind and purity of deed are the warehouses. Deal with the saints. They are sound and reliable customers." See what kind of a guy he was. A regular guy. Yeah, very, very, very fine. So, his father finally, in desperation, real desperation, turned him out. Now, that's very hard to take, because you'd think that he would understand a little bit. But he did turn him out, and he ran off to his sister's house. Sister and her husband took him in and kept him for a while, and were very good to him, and he loved them, and he stayed with them. And they persuaded him to take a job. Now, what do you think that job was? It was the government dispenser of alms. The government, the local government's dispenser of alms, so that he could make his living by giving away, by serving others and giving them whatever they wanted, needed. And he did well at it. See, because there was a job to his heart. It gave him this opportunity to serve others, to love others, and see others as divine. And so he throve, I guess that's the word, as a dispenser of alms. And as he was doing that, he got inspired. Apparently the spiritual life had developed so much in his heart that he felt like preaching. So what he did was, in the evenings, after the shop was after the job was done, after he finished his almsgiving, he would come back to the house and invite people to come and hear him talk. And so he began to give evening discourses there in the Punjab. And if you want to know to whom did he give these discourses, it's known, it's recorded, that there were in his congregation, something like our congregation, there were Vaishnavas, Shaivites, Sunni Muslims, Shia Muslims, and Hindus. Hindus were there. And so there weren't any Sikhs yet. But there were Vaishnavas and Shaivites, Sunni and Shia Muslims. Some people got jealous of his prominence, his popularity. That people came from all over, and there were a large number of people that gathered in the evening to sit there and listen to Nanak preach and talk about very simple religion. You know, I'll tell you in a few minutes what he preached, what he talked about. And it was very appealing to these poor farmers and merchants and people who were of the lower classes there in that area. And some people got jealous, and they began to try to find fault with him. And so they arranged to have his accounts examined by a high authority in the county. And the accounts were examined, and what was found was that everybody's account was quite complete and perfect except Nanak's, and his wages were in default. He hadn't collected his wages. Everybody else had got theirs. It was in arrears, I should say, not in default, in arrears. Well, he ran that shop for about 10 years before he gave up and got this other job. So you see, he didn't, that he had no stability. If one likes to think that these people who are very spiritual have no worldly common sense and are not practical at all, he shows us that's not true, because he was able to hold down these positions quite a period. Well, the turnaround, the big change in his life, came in 1499. He disappeared for 3 days. And the faithful who followed him informed the body of his followers, believe this, that he went out into the forest and had his epiphany, his great experience, his great realization. Turned him inside out, changed his whole being. Saw the light, any way you want to put it, however you like to put it. His conversion is, in the real sense, conversion of his whole life and thought. He came back out of the forest after 3 days with the Mula Mantra, what's called the Mula Mantra. Now, what is Mula? Mula is root. And so what he means by Mula Mantra is that mantra which all of the people who listen to him should repeat, and which I suppose he thought everybody in the world should repeat, but anyway, those whom he could influence should repeat. And that Mula Mantra translated goes like this: there is one God. He is the Supreme Truth. He is without fear. He is not vindictive. Take note. He is timeless, eternal. He is not born to. He does not die to be reborn. He is self-illumined, and by Guru's grace, he is revealed to the human soul. Truth was in the beginning and throughout the ages. Truth is now and ever will be. Apparently he felt this was revealed to him, and that is the basic mantra which is on which the Granth Sahib and all the other verses that he wrote are based. So when this great experience came over Nanak and changed him completely, he resigned his post as the alms distributor. And he put on, let me tell you what he put on to become the itinerant preacher of the day. He put on fakir's garb. That is to say, he had a white, he had an ochre shirt on, and then over that he put a white coat, white jacket, and then on top of that he put a yellow Muslim turban. So this is symbolic, combining Hindu and not only Hindu sannyasi and Muslim householder and sannyasi together, and also Hindu and Muslim together. That's what it all comes up to. He preached in a graveyard, so people were absolutely sure he was mad. Nobody preached in a graveyard. Now, you remember Sri Ramakrishna used to go and haunt the graveyards, and, because nice quiet place, and the people whom you talk to can't talk back. I figure that's the reason. So he preached to the graves, and everybody was thought he mad, of course, because why would you go and preach to dead people? But people came and listened and sat before him. And one of the things that he said, of course, which didn't win him many converts, was, there's no such thing as a Hindu and no such thing as a Muslim. And he told the Muslims, let compassion be your mosque. You don't need a mosque outside, a physical mosque. Let compassion be your mosque. And among the Hindus, he would expose like a naked sword their hypocrisies, the priests' hypocrisies, wherever there were corrupt officials who claimed to be pious Hindus, he would point out to them they were not being good Hindus. And he had harsh words and saucy talk for the Pandas, the people who guard the shrines and temples and make such a show of being upright and righteous. Their lives didn't show it, so he would get light into them. What he preached was a simple theism, as you saw in the Mula Mantra, a very simple kind of creed. The truth is eternal. I mean, these are the truths of the Veda, the truths of the Upanishads. Yes, they're all based in Hinduism. They're all brought in Hinduism. But where the Hindus failed to carry out, the ones that he saw, failed to carry out the implications of their creed, he was merciless. And he just simply told them, you're not following, you're not being what you are to be, what you claim to be. And he would put it into poetic form, as you can understand, I've already told you. You make the thread out of compassion and spin out of contentment and so on and so forth. In fact, he felt that rituals and ceremonies would generally stand in the way of true experience of God. And that's why you find that in the gurudwaras today, in the Sikh temples called gurudwaras, you find there is very little ritual. Well, some ritual is always there. And the ritual has replaced, the ritual of the Granth Sahib has replaced the rituals that he decried. But that's a later story. In the beginning, Nanak, as he was in the beginning, did not perform rituals, and he decried them. And you know that story, that story, wonderful story, that he went to the temple, went to one of the Hindu temples to spend the night, and because the temple kept open at night, he could go in. He went in and he slept there for the night. A wonderful place to sleep, in the presence of God. And the Panda, the priest, came in to the temple and said, "What are you doing? You slept with your feet turned toward the deity." Now, in India, in Hindu custom, you don't have your feet turned, pointing at the shrine or the deity. And Nanak said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Excuse me. Will you please turn my feet to the direction where God is not?" So his preaching was an exposure of hypocrisy and the cheating and the bribery and the corruption that went on around him in the society, which was pretending to be pious, whether Hindu or Muslim. He took 5 journeys in his career, his life. He lived quite a long time. He had a chance to do this. The first journey was to the pilgrimage places of India, some of the main pilgrimage places, mainly in the north, of course. He went all the way out to Puri. And so this is one reason why you find Sikhs everywhere in India. You find almost everywhere that you go, you find Sikhs, because Nanak made these journeys, and his influence pervaded it. You know, it dropped off wherever he happened to travel and to talk. So his first one was to Varanasi, and then finally off to the end, to the ocean at Puri. And the second one was to visit Kashmiri Pandits, who went up to Kashmir, where I suppose he met Kashmir Shaivism and other kinds of Hindu pundits in Kashmir, and the Himalayas, and Lahore. These were places where he went on the second trip. And then another trip was to Muslim shrines. He wasn't taking sides. He went to the Muslim shrines, the holy places of Makkah, Medina, Baghdad. Baghdad, now Baghdad is a place where Nanak went and lived and taught and made pilgrimage. So we have to, you know, acknowledge those holy places in his life. And he went, I think his last trip was on to places right near home, around his own part of the Punjab, the local places in the Punjab whose names I didn't recognize. He made his last pilgrimage. Who's speaking?
Did he go to Jerusalem?
Jerusalem. I don't know. I didn't hear that he went to Jerusalem. I don't think he had any knowledge or connection with Jewish people. He just Muslims.
But of course, Jerusalem is a major Muslim site.
That's true. He could have gone there. I didn't find it, but maybe he did. It's possible. I don't. Binyar says no. Raj thinks he didn't.
He went all the way up to the Baghdad and he came back.
Yeah. Okay. As he went through these travels and got familiar with the country, it's just like Swami Vivekananda. I see the same thing that I saw in Swami Vivekananda. He wept with the suffering of the people which the Mughal rule empire had imposed upon them. He saw how, he said, these rulers, they claimed to be Muslims, and then he would explain to the Muslims how un-Muslim were the Mughals, and how corrupt their rule, and what misery they had imposed upon the society, upon the poor, and how they had done nothing to relieve the distressed people of the land, and especially Babar distressed him very much, the actions and behavior of Babar. And so that was his concern, and that's what he preached about, seeing all that terrible condition of the people. He tried to do his best to make some kind of reform. Well, somewhere along the line, about this time, he acquired the name of Guru, and it was called after that. It was called Guru Nanak. He taught and preached the unity and equality of religions. A very much a man of today. I mean, you know. If we were to have, we often do have Sikhs in our in interfaith dialogues and meetings, and they always are on the side of this kind of mutual understanding of not having arguments about names or about doctrines, but always getting together on spiritual principles, the principles of right conduct and right thinking and so on. And That's the legacy that he left. He wandered around and taught for 22 years, blending the worldly and the spiritual modes of life. He was not a sannyasin in an order. He wasn't he wasn't inducted into a monastic order. But he lived as a sannyasin after he had a family. He had first family and had a couple of children and a wife. But he left the worldly life and really wandered as a sannyasin, more or less, though he didn't teach renunciation as such. He taught against image worship because he thought that, as I said, the images got in the way and led people to adopt the external instead of the interior. He wanted them to have the interior mode of relation to God and not exterior. He always stressed inwardness, and I would like to point that out to the Sikhs of today. The ones that I have known, some of the ones I have known, have not shown that same interest in inwardness, inward consciousness, too much concerned with political agendas and so on. I have known some who were not, they were very inward. I knew one Sikh, Sardar in Texas, who, when I was working in Houston, he came and made friends with me, and he was just the most inward person I can imagine. He's very, very sweet-natured and totally given to prayer and japa and all these things that just reminded me of Nanak very much. So you do find people like that, but not always, because in England, well, I'm going to tell a little more about that later. So he had this Garawa shirt, and then a white a wrapper around that, and the Muslim hat, and he put a saffron tilak on his forehead. In Varanasi, he talked to the chief Brahmin. You know, he was absolutely fearless, intrepid. He would go to the highest priests. He would go to the top authority in the place that he went to. He would find out the VIPs and go to them and challenge them. He went in Varanasi. Can you imagine going to the chief Brahmin in Varanasi? And he told him, "You are worshiping this shalagram." This particular person had a shalagram, which is a representative of the feminine genitals. Sometimes it's called that. And he was worshiping this stone, this shalagram. And he said to him, "Worship the shalagram not by making offerings, but by having completely chaste conduct," which I don't think sat well with the chief Brahmin. Now, an important thing, by this purification of Hinduism, this is something that's been remarked on by several. Swami Vivekananda remarked on this. By this particular, by Nanak's purification of Hinduism in those areas, Punjab and all, he helped to prevent Hinduism from being swamped by Islam. You understand? Islam was so overwhelming, so strong, so powerful, especially with arms. And Islam could have the patient and pacifistic Hindus could easily have been completely wiped out by Islam. And Nanak had a role in preventing that from having happened. That's important to notice. Let me see. Poet Kabir was now an old man that they met. And Nanak and Kabir, of course, very simpatico, like-minded souls, and they must have had a very good time together. He associated with him, and I suppose they read each other their poems. He didn't become a disciple of Kabir. Kabir has his own sampradaya, his own following. Kabir had people that followed Kabir, another segment of society. But Nanak certainly must have appreciated his association with Kabir, must have learned from him, and enjoyed that association. When it came time for Nanak to look to the end of life and realize that he had founded a movement with, I suppose, thousands of followers, and the question of succession came up. The question with which I'm familiar. And he passed over, and this is the interesting thing, he very often such movements, if they are of householders, they go from father to son. The Sufis often do that. Just recently, Pir Vilayat died and his son is becoming his successor, and so on. But Nanak, Guru Nanak, passed up his family. Although he had a son who was probably worthy, and he put two men whom he picked out to awful tests. I don't know what they are. They weren't described. And better not be, probably. I don't think you'd want to know what those tests were. He put to awful tests, it says in the books, the two men who he thought would be the best to succeed him, to see which would be the better. And Angad, became known later as Guru Angad, won the Angad, A-N-G-A-D, he won the prize, and was appointed to take over the movement. And Nanak died in 1539 while singing one of his own songs. Mm-hmm. Now that ought to appeal to you. Singing one of his own songs, he passed away. What a wonderful way to go, wouldn't it? Isn't that wonderful? That's what I know of his life. I want to say a few things about the religion. I don't want to offend anyone. I have had some experience with it. You know, I guess the vast majority of Hindus still regard Sikhism as a kind of an aberrant family member. They very often in India regard the Sikhs as just one of their own sects. But if you ask the Sikhs themselves about it, you get a different answer, you get a different story. They don't want to be considered Hindus. And the farther they get away from their country, the more prominent this distinction becomes. I lived in England for 7 years, almost 7 years, and there was a large, large immigration of Sikhs to London in England, as there is.
Canada.
Canada? Yes, oh yes, well I haven't been in Canada, I lived in England. And I saw them in, of course, many Hindus too. And so the Gurdwaras and the Hindu temples are growing up in London together. And I had to go around to the schools and talk about Hinduism, and invariably the Sikhs would insist that I be followed by one of the Sikh leaders to explain that Sikhism was different from Hinduism and give its own particular doctrines. And so I got well acquainted with some of the chief representatives of the Sikhs in England. And I found them very learned and very wise men and very helpful with interfaith dialogue with the association of different faiths. They have been a force for mutual understanding and agreement and association and welcoming of all kinds of varieties of religion, and it's been very helpful. On the other hand, there have been spokesmen for the faith who have been very political, who have been very antithetical, antipathy, shown great antipathy to the Hindus, criticized and scolded the Hindus, and insisted that they were superior and so on. And that's not the kind of Sikhs we want to have to emulate. But as I say, when you meet many individuals, I should say, have shown an exemplary fidelity to their faith, fidelity to their beliefs and doctrines. Unfortunately, I think in England, many have become Westernized, and so have Hindus, of course. But the creed, the fundamental creed, the five, you know, the five injunctions they are met, put upon the Sikhs, small dagger, they're supposed to keep a small dagger with them, wear shorts, never cut their hair, and so on. And they're supposed to refrain from tobacco and intoxicants. I didn't find that to be so in England. Intoxicants and tobacco are quite prominent in some Sikh families. Yeah, anyway, like everybody else in the world, they have a wonderful ideal, and we honor and support that. And like everybody else in the world, that we all fail to live up to it in all respects. Let me talk for a minute about the scripture. It's called the Adi Granth Sahib, the primal book, the holy primal Granth. Granth means book, because they used to tie the pages together with a knot. So the word Granth, which means knot, became the name for book, word for book. So this is the Adi Granth Sahib, the original holy book. And it consists of, somebody else tell me how many, I've forgotten, how many verses, big book, many verses all composed by Nanak and his followers. And they're not all by Nanak, some of them are by the other 10 gurus. Nanak was succeeded in his lineage by 9 other gurus, one after another, each one appointing his successor, usually. And it wasn't a family line. It was a lineage of worth. The last one, Guru Gobind Singh, said that he was going to be the last guru, the last human guru. The lineage would end with him. And apparently he had a revelation to this effect, that the lineage of gurus would end with him, and from now on the book alone would be the guru. So here you have a case of, and the most unusual case, of the holiness starting with a human being and winding up with a book. In Judeo-Christian tradition, you practically have the opposite. You start with the books and you wind up with a human being. So religion shows different patterns in different faiths. There are a lot of different patterns. And here's a most interesting and unusual pattern, where the book itself becomes the substitute for the line of gurus. Guru Gobind Singh was an immense influence in India. He was a tremendous power, a guru. And he did wonderful things, many wonderful things. He said he was the last. And this would be, and Swami Vivekananda talks a lot about Guru Gobind Singh. If you want to look up in the works, you'll find a lot of passages in which he praises his patriotism and his heroism and so on, and his purity. And another thing about the Sikhs is that there has always been an emphasis on the equality of women. Nanak himself started it. He always complained about the way women were treated as unequal, and I think if he had had a priesthood, he would have made women priests. And it's kept up, it has kept up through the ages, through the centuries since then, that women are all given the equal opportunity for education, and for, because there is no priesthood, there's not that, that question doesn't arise. So you find much more of a representation of gender equality in this faith than you do in some others. I want to quit a little early because I know that there are some of you who have been come from those parts of the country, or who have been in the past had family influences from the Sikh area or from the Sikhs themselves. So I would like to have you, who know more than I do about it, I've represented what I know and what I've found in books and what I've experienced, but I would like to have this discourse filled out by those who can say whether I've made a mistake somewhere or whether there's more to add that you'd like to add to it. Say.
Only one thing about the word itself, Sikh. Sikh
is disciple.
To teach.
Yes.
To Sikh. Teach, and from the teachings of
right.
Swami, not Swami.
Sikha. But Sikh, you mean first to learn and then to teach. Learn and then to teach, yes.
Do you think that he, like Jesus, it appears, never intended to start a new religion? Do you think Guru Nanak also did not intend to start a new religion, but it just came about that way, or do you think he actually...
Oh, that's a good question. Nanak himself did not, I think, intend to start a new religion. No. He wanted the Hindus and the Muslims to get along together and to learn to tolerate and revere each other. But the movement, like all movements, becomes, we must protect ourselves. How do you isolate any movement? I mean, we have it in our own order, in our own Ramakrishna movement. How do you keep from being frittered away and chipped off at the edges? How do you contain yourself and keep your continuity without somehow defining yourself? And so you go on and you define yourself, and then you have to redefine as the ages go on. And so that in through these centuries, the Sikh movement has built up a continuity and a definition and an identity, which is its own. Yes. Now, Vijay, you wanted to...
First, just to give a little background and few anecdotes. I happen to come from the part of India, Punjab, where Nanak was from, and he has had extreme influence.
Okay.
Nanak has extreme influence on people in Punjab,
yes.
But far from Punjab, in part of India that has become Pakistan, part called Sindh, which is now in Pakistan, the people from Sindh revere Nanak as their guru.
The Sindhis.
Yes, Sindhis. Sindhis revere Nanak as their guru. Second, that in Punjab, the Hindus, once upon a time, until only a few decades ago, and maybe even today in the villages, it may be so, that if in any family they are not able to have a child for a long, long time, and then they, by grace of God, have a child, son, they make that first son sick.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. As
a mark of
thanks to Almighty who gave them the grace.
Mm-hmm.
So they make, but they make him a sick, they make him like...
No, name him.
No, he becomes sick.
Oh, make him
sick.
Oh, I thought you said name.
Make.
No, not only the name.
Make
in every way.
Make him sick.
Both in terms of
so one brother would be a Sikh, the others would be.
Yes.
Right. Oh, that's why it happens. I see.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at all. Yeah. Very interesting.
Actually, the oldest son would become a Sikh. For example, my mother,
uh-huh.
her my grandmother, my mother's mother, had two brothers. The older one was a Sikh, and the younger one was a Hindu. And, you know, they grew up practicing both, whatever, Sikhism and Hinduism, so they'd go to the Gurdwara and they'd go to the temple and so on and so forth. Yeah. So it was not uncommon for, you know, the oldest son in the family. One son would be a Sikh and the rest would be,
Isn't that democratic? Very, very, very good.
Well, that you could see then now why the Hindus think that the Sikhs are in. Just Hindus.
Both ways. Both are responsible.
The difference comes. The difference comes that, as Swamiji, you pointed out a while ago, the Hindus accept Sikhs as a part of the family, but it's not the same the other way around, and if it is, same, not to the same degree.
Very
a case in point being that in case there's an intercaste marriage, the Hindu will accept Sikh, but the Sikh accepting Hindu in the marriage has to convert the other person, the Hindu, to Sikhism.
Like a Catholic church.
My wife's sister is married to Sikh, and the requirement was, and it was a love marriage, it's not that it was imposed, they loved each other, but there was a condition imposed by the groom's parent, who was a Sikh, that she had to become Sikh before being accepted in our family.
Well, now I'm willing to wager that among the Muslims, this doesn't pertain the same. The Sikh influence among the Muslims is not like that, I'm sure. The Muslims don't consider the Sikhs as part Muslim, do they?
Oh, not at all.
No, they don't.
They are at Nagar strong.
If you look at the history of Sikhism in Islam, they were always at conflict.
Yes.
In fact, the last Guru, Guru Gobind Singh, died in practically war. He was murdered by Muslims. His whole life was spent in the war. Not only him, all of the Guru Ramdev and all of the things. Sikhism is not a kind of mixture of take something from Hinduism and something from Muslims.
In other words, Nanak didn't really succeed with the Muslims. He succeeded with the Hindus.
Kabir tried, Nanak tried, but they did not succeed. Yeah. The animosity continues till today.
Yes?
Two informational quips and one little concept which I got from your very timely lecture today. And before I go, thank you very much that, you know, your whole idea of bringing all kinds of saints and their thinking, you know, it really improves our circulation of thoughts enormously well. So I wanted to thank on behalf of everyone that you are doing that. Recently in London, in Gurudwara, Queen Elizabeth was invited, but it is required that she has to take her shoes off.
And
a queen never does that. But
she what?
To take the shoes
and
off.
She refused.
No. She
agreed?
Said, I will remove my shoes and come.
Oh.
And that was... Wow. Since you are from England, and her picture with the bare feet was there.
She respected.
So that to me was just amazing.
Well, now I lived under her rule for 6 years, and I didn't know that about her. I'm very proud of her now.
The second thing, Shaligram, Swamiji, is different from Linga. You described Linga, which is a phallic symbol.
No, I didn't say that. I said the feminine genitals.
You said what?
Feminine genitals.
It's not feminine genitals. Shaligram is just a dark, rounded
I know, yes, but...
representing Vishnu as opposed to Linga representing Shiva.
All right, but another interpretation of it, Bhagirath.
Okay, fine.
There's another interpretation.
This is the way we have heard, you know, right?
Yeah.
What is right?
Anyway, apparently Nanak interpreted it this way because he was making a point of the sexual part of it. Yeah.
The third thing, you know, the initial thing that you selected today, the shloka, was so perfect, so perfect, that just in the way that different rivers meet and ultimately empty out in the ocean.
Yeah.
But I was thinking at the body language, we also call, you know, the Venus circles, we call it the river, the Venus river. And that also, you know, each one is a different name at different part of the anatomy.
Oh.
And finally, all of them merge
and
empty into the right side of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But here is the catch, and here I think body is much better, that the body knows that the one coming from the right side is a partially impure blood. It has got to be purified because it goes into the circulation again. And I think that's where the religion fails.
Oh.
In the sense that, you know, they all tried to do that, let's improve. You know, basically, Nanak wanted to improve upon Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
Buddha wanted to improve upon Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to have different kind of an interfaith thing. They wanted to remove all the impurities that they had gathered that one. That's the reason why they refused to accept that they are Hindus. Buddhas don't want to accept that.
Yeah.
Sikhs don't want to accept that. Because the impurity, the package comes with that one.
Mm-hmm.
But if it ever goes through the purification and recirculate, then you'll find that.
Right, that's a very technical thing.
But
raised a very technical.
But that's an interesting analogy, because Christianity tried to improve upon Judaism, and then Muslims also tried to improve upon both Judaism
and Christianity.
But I will say that in Judaism they worship the book. You know, there are different sects of Judaism. You know, the Messianic sect wants the Messiah to come back again, the Chabadism, and so forth. But basically, it's the Torah, the first five books. And, you know, the rabbis are just teachers. Mm-hmm. They're not anybody special, but teachers.
They're not priests.
Literally, they put the book on the big pedestal and worship.
Well, they have their ritual, of course.
Yes, for the Jewish religion, They bring out the Torah and bring it around the room, and everybody kisses the Torah with your prayer book, or your the men wear these shawls with the strings of the shawls. They're holy, and so it goes around the room and so forth. Yeah, and there's a whole holiday called Simchas Torah where there's a lot of celebration because it's the day that the Torah was given to the Jewish people. So in all the synagogues all over the world, there's a big celebration, singing, and chanting,
etc. Everybody, everyone finished?
I have a question. And at what point in time did the requirements for the Sikhs to have the five basic
K's, the five K's?
When did they really start? Was it toward the
Gobind Singh.
Right.
Because I heard that.
Khalsa. That only came with the last guru.
Yeah,
okay.
Gobind Singh.
So imagine, you can imagine all those centuries before that, those were not the hallmarks of a Sikh.
Right.
And when we might want to know, wonder what a Sikh's hallmarks were before that time. But he really defined it. Yes.
What are they again?
Okay.
Kirpan is for sword. Kesh is for hair.
Don't your hair.
That starts with K. Kacha is for the underwear. That starts with K.
Kavach.
Kavach is bracelet. That starts with K. And
the comb.
The comb.
Kanga.
Kanga.
Oh, we got it now.
What about these things? So you're never to cut the hair?
Yes.
Keep
all of these.
I will keep a comb with you, sword with you, and be dressed.
And all men would have that special bracelet.
Oh, okay.
Now we're getting close to time to get
Swamiji, I have a request. Yeah. Can you read out one or two poems?
I did. I read the only two verses I could find. I couldn't. I don't have in the library. We must get it. We must get some of his verses.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I don't have books.
Sufi poetry and Nanak.
We have lots of Sufis. Yeah. I didn't have any Nanak poetry. For some reason, I couldn't find any this morning.
Just
anyway.
One ending note, if it's okay with you. If anybody's interested, in one of the Sunday sessions, I can bring a tape. Just to give a flavor of what does that music of Sikhs sound like.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't have to play the entire tape, maybe for 2 minutes or 3 minutes, if people would like to have a flavor. It's a very beautiful devotional melody.
Okay.
And it's all based on actually Indian classical music.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very similar.
Raj,
I mean, Indian classical music was heavily involved, I mean, influenced by the Muslims, you know, for Persian music too, so.
It's very possible.
So Raj wants to say something.
I have a question. I'm sorry if I missed that part.
No, I'm saying a lot of the ragas were not a Hindu
origin.
What method prescribed for God realization to his disciples? What did he tell
them to do? Devotion, pure bhakti. Yes, prema, you know, we call it prema, supreme devotion to God without the use of any external appurtenances like images or charms or just the mool mantra, you see? Mm-hmm. The mool mantra? That Japa. Repeat, japji. Repeat that. Yes. It was called the japji.
When you
repeat
the mool mantra.
Yes, that's the main method. Now we have to close this. Is there anybody who doesn't know what time we meet next Sunday?
Where?
And where? And all your friends and relatives.
We're starting lunch, so don't eat before you come.
No, don't eat before you come. But I'd like, first of all, before we say our prayer, quote our benediction, I'd like to mention that we have a new visitor, Vanessa.
Patience.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Your name isn't Vanessa. Oh.
when you said to me, your name is Vanessa, and she looked at me and she goes, patience. She was saying to me, be patient.
That's putting in a newsletter.
Well, anyway, welcome, patience. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
And let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. One more thing I have to say, and that is that I think it took I had to screw up my courage to give this talk today. I know so little about it firsthand.
That's good. That's good. It increases participation.